This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
This is what bipartisanship means. You know, when the Democrats and Republicans say bipartisan, we as working people should shudder, because it means more war, more bloodshed. It means more exploitation. It means more cuts to our basic services. So on the one hand, you have trillions of dollars of cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, and on the other hand, trillions of dollars for war.
Kishana Sawant, independent socialist and former Seattle City Council member, is now running against Democratic Congressman Adam Smith in Washington's 9th District. She talks about the lessons of Minneapolis and the dangers of war.
The Solidarity Center is an instrument in U.S. foreign policy to suppress leftist movements and left governments, for that matter, around the world.
Frank Hammer, retired president of UAW Local 909, discusses Trump and the Republicans' about-face in supporting the funding of the National Endowment for Democracy, which provides some $70 million a year for the anti-working class international operations of the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center.
So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital.
The late Michael Parenti analyzed the historical and economic underpinnings of fascist movements and explored the often overlooked class dynamics behind fascism in his 1990 lecture, The Functions of Fascism. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Former Seattle City Councilor and Socialist Kishama Sawant is now running against Washington Democrat Adam Smith in the state's 9th Congressional District. Smith, who has held the seat since 1997, is a big supporter of the military-industrial complex. Sawant spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the developments in Minneapolis and the growing threat of world war.
We have seen Democratic Governor Tim Walz in Minnesota right now. You know, the Democrats are not joining the protests against ICE. They instead are making a deal with Donald Trump. And then what they have done, Tim Walz's first action was to call in the National Guard, to plan to call in the National Guard against the protests.
And of course, trade unions and others having the experience with the National Guard previously.
We need to remind working people at all times that the National Guard and the police department are not the friends of the working class. These are institutions of the capitalist state, and their very existence is meant to suppress any rebellion, any kind of revolt by the working class. So the alternative to the ICE terror by Donald Trump is not local police departments or the sheriff's office or the National Guard, because these are all various aspects of the apparatus of the capitalist state, all of which is stacked up against the working class. And the fact that the Democratic Party calls the National Guard against the protests, that should be revealing to people that the Democratic Party, far from being the so-called lesser evil, is actually, alongside the Republican Party, one of the two most powerful parties of global capitalism. It is very illustrative. It is, you know, very clearly illustrative of the need for international working class solidarity. Because when you look at these military budgets, when you look at what's happening, it shows you that internationally the capitalist class have their various alliances, their various enmities. And what ends up happening is that the capitalist governments of every country, I don't care, you know, I mean, it's the United States obviously is the dominant military spender. But at the same time, if you look at the military budgets of even my home country, India, for example, if you look at the military budgets in Western Europe, these are all massive, untold amounts of money that are being spent for imperialist war, bloodshed, and misery. I mean, it's exporting absolute death and starvation to countries. Obviously, Gaza is the most prominent, but it's also in other countries, Ukraine, Russia. It's exporting death and bloodshed. And who is gaining out of this? It is the international billionaire class that is gaining out of this. If you look at the profiteers of imperialist war and genocide, it is billionaires like Alexander Karp, but of Palantir. But it's not just him. It's also the tech billionaires. It's construction billionaires. In other words, the billionaire class as a whole is what profits from it. And all of this is playing out what's happening in the current stage of the crisis of capitalism, which is the conflict between the US-led bloc and the China-Russia-led bloc. And both of these, the capitalist classes on both sides, are completely willing and capable, willing to do it and capable of doing it, which is, they are willing to spill any number of drops of blood of the working class in order to emerge as the world leader. So in other words, for us as the working class, the conclusion cannot afford to make a fatal mistake of trying to align alongside our nationalistic interests. We are going to align with U.S. imperialism, and in China, the world people should align with Chinese imperialism, and same with Russia and Ukraine. That is absolutely fatal. Instead, we need to understand that the capitalist class and the state that operates alongside them, the governments, in other words, they are all completely hostile to the interests of the working class. And so if we are to have a reversal of the race to the bottom that all working people, billions of us, are facing, then we have to build movements on a class basis where we understand that our interests as American working people, for example, are aligned with the working people of every other country, and we have to oppose war, imperialist war, at every cost. And just to say one last thing, Steve. You talked about Trump already spending $1.5 trillion on the military. What did the Democrats and Republicans, the senators and Congress, House members, what did they do in December? They voted for the new National Defense Authorization Act, the so-called Defense Authorization Act, but it's really authorizing new military dollars. It's another nearly $1 trillion. And the Democrats in their hundreds voted for this. Adam Smith, my opponent, voted for this. So it is the Democrats and Republicans both absolutely driving. This is what bipartisanship means. When the Democrats and Republicans say bipartisan, we as working people should shudder, because it means more war, more bloodshed. It means more exploitation. It means more cuts to our basic services. So on the one hand, you have trillions of dollars of cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, and on the other hand, trillions of dollars for war.
That was Kishama Sawant, socialist and independent and former Seattle city councilor who is now running to replace Democratic Congressman Adam Smith of Washington's 9th District.
Fearless against ICE. Fearless for our members' rights. Fearless against your SS Gestapo. Fearless against your mafia capos. Fearless in Baltimore forevermore. Fearless Portland, Oregon, and Maine. Fearless, ice we disdain. Fearless from here to the stars. Fearless is who we are. Fearless from Philly to Texas. Fearless with all the rest for. Fearless from Chi-Town to Compton. Fearless there ain't no stopping. Fearless from Rio to Cali. Fearless like Sally. Fearless to get your ass. Fearless from first to last. Fearless against the drugs. Fearless from Philly to Compton. Fearless from Philly to country. Fearless against your machine.
Fearless against ICE from the Teamsters. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Thomas O'Rourke. The U.S. Congress has voted to appropriate $315 million to the National Endowment for Democracy in 2026. The NED has been giving roughly $70 million a year to the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center, which has 400 employees and operates in 62 countries. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviews Frank Hammer, retired UAW Local 909 president, about the resumption of funding of the NED and Solidarity Center, and why the AFL-CIO is now accepting money from Trump for the AFL-CIO's international operations.
This budget session that we had recently brought about a interesting turn, because under the Trump people, including Musk, and others, they wanted to shut down funding for the National Endowment for Democracy. Maybe you can explain what the National Endowment for Democracy is and why they wanted to shut it down.
The National Endowment for Democracy, which sounds really great, sounds like the National Endowment for the Arts or Humanity.
Or it's his peace committee, you know. Peace,
right.
Committee. Yeah, same thing.
It was created in 1983 at the behest of Ronald Reagan by the U.S. Congress. And it set up four institutes that would receive government funding through the instrument of the NED that included the International Chamber of Commerce, the International Democratic Party, the Republican Party. Those were three of them. And then the other one was the U.S. Solidarity Center that was under the, you know, the umbrella of the AFL-CIO. So this money that Congress was bestowing on NED was split up between those four institutes. And one of the recipients of that government money was the international arm of the AFL-CIO, which beginning in 1997 was called the Solidarity Center. It had a longer name, but it was an institute that was brought into being in 1997 to replace the former instruments of international policy, one of which was the American Institute for Free Labor Development, for which my brother worked. So there's a real line of continuity between the role that my brother was playing in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, early 80s, and what we see today as the Solidarity Center that's funded by the NED.
And the kind of operation that we're talking about, apparently they've received over $1 billion from the U.S. government. They have 200 agents in the United States and 200 members abroad. Operations in 62 countries. When you think about the AFL-CIO, I think most workers are unaware that the largest group of employees in the AFL-CIO is funded by the U.S. government for international operations. What does that mean? And what does that say about the role of the AFL-CIO and why the U.S. government would fund this operation?
Well, so what makes it particularly an interesting question at this moment is that the Republicans had been besides themselves about the U.S. funding the NED, which includes, of course, the U.S. foreign labor operations. And so there's been a real open debate about whether tax money should go to the NED or not. And that open debate has enabled us to take a peer in, because by and large, it was a very secretive operation, especially around labor. It allows us to peer in to what the arguments are among the, you know, elements of the capitalist class about the funding of the NED. Now, the NED, so recently, as part of the funding operations that had to be done by the U.S. government by January 30th, one of those four different elements of that funding had to do with funding the State Department and other foreign operations that included NED to the tune of over $310 million. And there were Republicans that tried to make an amendment to that appropriation saying, we don't want to fund this institute, the NED, because it promotes leftist ideology overseas and undermines the America First plan, going forward. And we think it should be taken out of the appropriations. And there were like 81 other Republicans that responded and voted to continue the funding of the NED, which includes funding for the AFL-CIO operations overseas. So you got to really wonder, why are the Republicans rushing in to make sure, and the Republicans who voted for it cited that Trump himself supported this funding for the NED, part of which was into the Solidarity Center in the name of the AFL-CIO. So you have to ask yourselves, especially as working class, as people that are represented by unions that belong to the AFL-CIO, was, it was over 65 unions. Why would the AFL-CIO be in the good graces of Donald Trump to the point that Donald Trump is spearheading the refunding of the AFL-CIO? And that's something that we've not heard any discussion about, any debate. Should we, as labor, as representatives of working class in the U.S., be bending over backwards to receive this money from Trump for the overseas operations? What does it mean that the AFL-CIO is part of the narrative about America first? And I thought we're supposed to be working class first.
And the Solidarity Center director actually wrote a document, a legal brief, talking about why it should be continue to be funded. Maybe you can talk about that, because that was not widely distributed among working people, this legal brief about why the U.S. government should fund them. What was she about? That was Shauna Bader Blau, who's the executive director of the Solidarity Center.
Solidarity Center has always operated under the mantra of we're promoting democracy. And the most reactionary elements within the Republican Party agree with that framing, and it is therefore are opposed to it. But the other framing, which of course is not put forward by the AFL-CIO, but which is the narrative that actually explains why the government continues to fund it, it's because it's the instrument for suppressing the left in all those countries that you mentioned. It's over 60 countries. And that she did not mention. She did not mention, or at least not very candidly, that the Solidarity Center is an instrument, U.S. foreign policy, to suppress leftist movements and left governments, for that matter, around the world. And the question is that the appropriate role for the AFL-CIO to be playing? During my brother's time, it was all done in the name of, we got to take down the Soviet Union. It's the bad character in the room. And now that when the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, well, we had to find another enemy to do this in the name of. And now it's, we have to limit China's influence abroad and so on. It's an incessant narrative. And that is in part how the AFL-CIO explains what they are doing.
And part of the funding of the National Endowment for Democracy was going to build so-called democratic unions and intervene building these unions in Venezuela. They were involved in an attempted coup in Venezuela. They've been involved in overthrowing governments, not only in Chile, but Argentina, Brazil, Guatemala. They were involved in South Africa. That's before the National Endowment for Democracy, supporting Chief Buthelezi, who was given the Mini Award by the AFL-CIO. He killed trade unions who were organizing there. He supported Bantustans in South Africa. And most significantly, in relation to your brother, the Histadrut, which is the Israeli Trade Union Federation, is a partner with the AFL-CIO internationally. In fact, wasn't your brother trained at the Histadrut national offices in Israel?
So, yeah, there's a very close connection. And my brother did go for training purposes to Israel. And when he was doing that, that was part and parcel. But the U.S. had something called the Phoenix Program to defeat the Vietnamese. And it was carrot and stick operations while it bribed some of the movements for liberation with money, which is what they feel was really good at doing in Latin America. On the other hand, you know, it was also the stick. And while they were offering the bribes, the military was decimating the peasants in the Vietnamese countryside. Same operation in the U.S. So I think just to go back to the time when my brother was in the service of AFIELD. AFIELD was, you know, I think a lot of workers will understand this, was a joint program. And by that, I mean that the original board governed the activity of the American Institute for Free Labor Development, a representative of AFL-CIO. 95 members of the board, original board, were corporate CEOs. So from the very beginning, and long before that, but certainly in the beginning of the American Institute for Free Labor Development, It has been an instrument of management, in certainly in Latin America. And that is very much in tune with the agenda of the CEOs of major corporations in support of Israeli Zionism. And so it's no surprise that Zionists in Israel, the Zionist government, would embark on supporting all these reactionary movements around the world in the service of capitalism and in the service of the U.S. corporations. And that's been how it's been used. And of course, the reciprocation is that the Israeli Zionists receive massive amounts of funding from the U.S. government to exercise its power and terrorism over the Palestinian people. So it's a mutually beneficial relationship. And unfortunately, the U.S. labor movement, and specifically my UAW, has never passed a resolution at any convention that I'm familiar with that addresses the question of the U.S. relationship with Zionism, never mind the UAW's relationship to the AFL-CIO program in Latin America. So it means that it's acquiescing to enemies of the working class. And I think that the latest episode with Trump wanting to fund the NED needs to be something that gets raised in the labor movement and saying, why are we carrying Trump's water overseas? Why are we carrying Trump's water in 60 countries, adversely affecting the working class and peasant movements in those countries? We have to take another look and say, no, thank you. We're not going to accept your money. We are part of a broad front that wants to bring you down, not cooperate with you.
That was Frank Hammer, retired president of UAW Local 909, talking about how Trump and the Republicans reversed course to renew funding of the NED, which in turn provides some $70 million a year for the international operations of the AFL-CIO's Solidarity Center.
Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. Military and the monetary. The military and the monetary get together whenever they think it's necessary. They turn our brothers and sisters into mercenaries. They are turning the planet to a cemetery. The military and the monetary use the media as intermediaries. They are determined to keep the citizens secondary. They make so many decisions that are arbitrary. We're marching behind the commander-in-chief who was standing under a spotlight shaking like a leaf. But the ship of state had landed on an economic reef, so we knew he was going to bring us messages of grief. The military and the monetary were shielded by January and went storming into February. Brought us pot-bellied generals as luminaries. 2 weeks ago, I hadn't heard of some, now all of a sudden, he's legendary. They took the honor from the honorary. They took the dignity from the dignitaries. They took the secrets from the secretary, but they left the an obituary.
Gil Scott-Heron, Work for Peace. You're listening to Pacific is Capitalism, Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Next, we share Michael Parenti's lecture, The Functions of Fascism, recorded on November 30th, 1990, as part of the Real History series. This lecture analyzes the historical and economic underpinnings of fascist movements and explores the often overlooked class dynamics behind fascism.
This is Michael Parenti, and welcome to Real History, a series of talks by me on different historical subjects that are relevant for understanding today's realities. Most people are never exposed to real history. In school, we usually don't read history, we read history textbooks, and mainstream ones at that, which avoid underlying realities and ones that propagate myths that serve the powers that be, myths that some of us find harmful to the truth and to democracy. So this is real history. This particular segment is entitled The Functions of Fascism. Fascism is a name that was given to the political movement that arose in Italy under the leadership of Benito Mussolini, who ruled that country from 1922 to 1943. Nazism, a similar movement led by Adolf Hitler, was Germany's dictator from 1933 to 45. It's considered by most observers to be a variant of fascism, as to a lesser degree is the militaristic government that controlled Japan from 1940 to 45. And the Falangist movement led by Francisco Franco in Spain, when the fascists there, with the military aid, by the way, of the Italian and Nazi fascists, took over after a protracted civil war. There are similar fascist or self-avowed fascist movements, but less successful ones arose in Eastern Europe and in Great Britain, the United States, France, and other Western industrial nations' movements. Some of them also came to power. We might recall today, when the press is full of news about how Bulgaria or Romania or Hungary or Lithuania are returning, or Poland are returning to their democratic roots by overthrowing communism, we might recall that they weren't democratic before communism came in. They were fascist. In fact, several of those countries, with the exception of Poland, were open allies of the Nazis. They were Nazi fascist allies. Now, like with a lot of terms like liberalism, democracy, socialism, communism, no single definition of fascism maybe will satisfy everybody. And with fascism, there's a really special problem, because it's a beguiling mix of revolutionary-sounding mass appeals and reactionary class politics. And the reactionary class politics are the part of fascism that our establishment historians, almost never talk about. Hitler's party, for instance, was called the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP, or Nazis. It's a very left-sounding name, National Socialist German Workers, and it was designed to win broad support among working people, even while the Nazis were destroying working-class organizations. In other words, fascism, the original Italian and German variations of fascism, was a political phenomenon that made a revolutionary appeal without making a revolution. It promised to solve the ills of the many while, in fact, protecting the special interests of the few with violence and terror. And it propagated a new political consciousness, a new order, a new nation to serve the same old capitalist system. Let me run down a couple of the major characteristics of the fascist ideology. First, there's a glorification of the leadership cult, the commitment to an absolutist and supreme leader, all-knowing, all-guiding, the Führerprinzip, as it's called, the Führer principle, the leader principle, I should say. Second, there's a glorification of the nation-state as an end in itself, as an entity unto itself, an absolute component, to which the individual is subsumed. Everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside of the state. That was Mussolini's dictum, and it was Hitler's also. In fact, with Hitler, Rudolf Hess once said, Adolf Hitler is Germany, Germany is Adolf Hitler, therefore combining both the leadership cult and the state cult in one. Third, there was a glorification of military conquest and jingoism, the glory of that the state is vitalized by subduing, conquering, taking other people, enslaving them. You increase your own power and your own glory. Fourth, there was the propagation of a folk mysticism, a xenophobia, and a racism. The Nazi slogan was, Ein Volk, ein Reich, ein Führer. One people, one state, one leader. Also, as other side of the folk mysticism, and this blood cult of the special blood, the special legacy, the atavistic wonders of our particular people, was a xenophobia, a hatred and a racism, a hatred of other peoples, other nationalities. With the Nazis and with most other Eastern European fascists, it was anti-Semitism. The Jew was seen as the perpetrator of all that was ill in society. The trade unionists, they were Jews. The communists, so forth and so on. And behind them stood this wicked, alien-blooded creature who would undermine our state. Fifth, there was an opposition, both in Italian fascism and in German Nazism, an opposition to socialism, to communism, to anarchism, and to all left egalitarian class movements and doctrines, along with opposition to trade unions, opposition to labor parties, opposition to other working-class political organizations. Of these various characteristics of Nazism, 1, 2, 3, 4 are often talked about by established historians and mainstream historians. That last one, though, opposition to labor unions, opposition to working-class parties, opposition to socialism and such, that one is never talked about by Western writers, especially American writers. The historians and the political scientists and the journalists who treat the subject of fascism usually write from a centrist ideological perspective. from the political center of the spectrum, which means they usually ignore the link between fascism and capitalism, just as they tend to ignore the entire subject of capitalism itself when there's something unfavorable to say about it. Instead, they dwell on the more phantasmic components of fascist ideology, the nihilistic revolt against Western rationalism and individuality, the irrational appeals to mass submission to a leader and all that. And fascism was those things, but along with its irrational appeals, it had rational functions. It was a rational instrument for class domination and for the preservation of the existing capitalist system. After World War I, Italy had a parliamentary government that seemed really incapable of solving the country's economic crises. Profits were declining, banks were failing, unemployment was rising. So to ensure profits, the big industrial giants and the big landowners would have to slash wages and raise prices. The state, in turn, would have to provide the big owners with tariff protections along with massive subsidies and tax exemptions. To finance this, the population would have to be taxed more heavily, their wages rolled back, and social welfare expenditures drastically cut. It sounds like Reaganism. Well, it is, even more extremely so. But the government wasn't totally free to apply these harsh measures. First of all, Italian workers and peasants had their own unions, they had political organizations, they had cooperatives, they had their own publications. And through the use of demonstrations and strikes, boycotts, factory takeovers, occupying farmlands, the forcible occupation of farmlands, they often won some very real concessions in wages and work conditions, unemployment benefits, and they won the right to organize. And even in the face of this worsening economic crisis, they were able to mount a troublesome defense of their standard of living. I mean, troublesome for those who own the land, the labor, and the capital, and the money in the banks, and the farms, and the factories. So the only solution really was to smash the worker and peasant organizations, in effect destroying all political and civil liberties, including the right to organize, agitate, and propagandize. The state would have to be more authoritarian and more firmly subservient to the interests of capital. Mussolini and his black shirts were around right after World War I, and for about 3 or 4 years, the big landowners and industrialists used their fascist goon squads, gave them money and gave them arms, and used them as kind of strike breakers, anti-labor militias. They styled themselves the United Front Against Bolshevism. In 1922, the big capital interests in Italy decided to go for the whole thing. Representatives of the Federation of Industry and the Federation of Agriculture, which was a agribusiness firm, and representatives of the National Banking Association, they all met together, and they met with Mussolini, and they planned the fascist march on Rome. Mussolini sat there and planned that with the leading capitalists of Italy. By the way, this is almost never mentioned in the accounts about the March on Rome. These big capitalists contributed 20 million lira toward that undertaking. In the words of Senator Ettore Conti, himself a very loyal representative of the moneyed interests, quote, "Mussolini was the candidate of the plutocracy, that is, of the wealthy, and the business associations." A very similar pattern, by the way, of coordination and compliance existed in Germany also, less than a decade later. German workers and farm laborers in the period following World War I under the Weimar Republic won some important economic concessions. They won an 8-hour day, they won unemployment insurance, they were able to elect shop committees, and they won the right to unionize. And again, during the 1920s, these paramilitary right-wing gangs, most notably Hitler's brown shirts, stormtroopers, were subsidized by business in a limited way and kept as a kind of reserve army, what Gourin called the bodyguard of capitalism. And their job again was to strike break and to harass organized workers and to beat up socialists and communists and such. The nearly total collapse of the German economy in 1929-30 presented the owning class with a momentous crisis. They had very big capital investments, and these left them with very high fixed costs that had to be met even as their plants lay idle. Only massive state aid could revive their profits. Wages and social welfare, human service expenditures had to be cut. Union contracts had to be abrogated. In fact, human contracts had to be abrogated too. Business would need new subsidies and tax exemptions. The crisis in agriculture was equally severe, and the large landed proprietors, the Junker class, demanded even higher subsidies, heavier duties on foreign agricultural imports, and an end to farm unions. These unions were holding wages up, and when wages were being sustained, you cut into profits. So by 1930, most of the influential landowners and big industrialists and bankers, especially the industrialists in steel, coal, and mining, had concluded that the Weimar Republic no longer served their interests, and no longer could protect their class, and that it was too accommodating to the working class and to certain sectors of light industry. So they greatly increased their subsidies to Hitler, and they propelled the Nazi Party onto the national stage. By 1930, most of the great industrialists and bankers were underwriting the Nazi Party. And what happened in 1930 with this injection of hundreds of millions of marks is that Hitler was able to catapult his party onto the national scene. It went from a cult of brown shirt thugs to a national party mobilized. In the election of 1930, the Nazi Party gained 107 seats in the Reichstag. And Hitler, later on, evoking the memory of what he called that astonishing campaign, told his listeners to think of, quote, what it means when 1,000 speakers each has a car at his disposal and can hold in a year 100,000 meetings. And in 1931 and 32, the subsidies from the big industrialists continued to grain in ever more abundantly. So the Nazis were projected onto the national stage, and they gained an ever larger presence in the Reichstag. Neither in Italy nor in Germany was revolution really something that was in the offing. I mean, it wasn't a real threat. The left was never strong enough to take state power in either of those countries. So the threat wasn't really from the left. The bourgeoisie resorted to fascism less in response to the disturbances in the street and more in response to the disturbances in their own economic system. The threat wasn't from the left. The threat was from their own economic systems and its contradictions, and the fact that democratic forces had developed enough democratic strength to resist the austerity and the rollback that the capitalists tried to impose to maintain their levels of profit. The sickness that these capitalists tried to banish was from within, not from without. The Italian and German monopolists, the big cartels, also had a direct interest in an expansionist military regime. They wanted a big rebuilding of the military, one that would, one, compensate, first of all, would compensate for the decline in investment opportunities with huge armament contracts and related public works. In other words, this industrial and financial class wanted a large defense budget, as we would call it, because it was a source of capital investment and enormous capital profits. Does that sound familiar? Two, they wanted to embark on an aggressive foreign policy to open new markets for export and investment, thereby gaining a more equal footing with French and English competitors. So the fascists really became a very valuable ally against the capitalists' two worst enemies. The capitalists' two worst enemies are, first, the workers in their own country, and the capitalists of foreign countries. And the genuineness, by the way, of fascism's hatred of workers and foreigners was never open to doubt, so they fit in quite snugly. Now, I don't mean to say that all the big industrialists and financiers supported fascism with equal fervor. Some, like Tyson, were early and enthusiastic backers of Hitler. The aged Emil Kerdorf thanked God that he lived long enough to see the Führer emerge as the savior of Germany. Others contributed money to the Nazis, but also to other anti-socialist parties on the right. They backed Hitler only when he promised to be the best hope for their interests. By the way, many of them still remain privately critical of the more extreme expressions of Nazi propaganda, and they were a little uneasy about the anti-bourgeois rhetoric sometimes used by some of the fascist plebeian elements. Some elements in business were not that hot for fascism. Light industry, which had lower fixed costs and more stable profits than heavy industry that was dependent on consumer buying power and such, the light industrialists were not that keen about a more aggressive foreign policy, about heavy in subsidies to heavy industry and the like. But when push came to shove, they may not have been close to the fascists, but they weren't about to ally themselves with the proletariat against the business class of which they were a part. And they pretty much sided with the dominant elements or kept their mouths shut. There was another element in these two societies that not only tolerated the rise of fascism, but supported it. And I'm talking about the parliamentary capitalist state itself. Not the government or the parliament as such, but the instruments of the state, the instruments that have the legal monopoly on force and violence, the police, the army, the courts, and the like, the secret intelligence agencies and such. In both Italy and Germany, years before Mussolini and Hitler emerged victorious, these elements, courts, police, the army, showed a real leniency and an open collaboration with fascism while harshly repressing the left. Mussolini and Hitler could not have come to power without the help of the state machineries, and that state machinery was never really against them. In Italy, the police collaborated with the fascists in attacking labor and peasant organizations. They recruited criminals for the fascist action squads, the squadristi, as they call it, squadristi. They promised them immunity from prosecution for past crimes. When applications for gun permits were regularly denied to workers and peasants, police guns and police cars were made available to Mussolini's goons. Germany, the same kind of thing went on. Immediately after the war, the military police and the judiciary sided with the rightists to suppress the left, a pattern of collaboration that continued to the day that Hitler took power. In other words, these supposed democracies, which were equally opposed to totalitarianism of the left and the right, were not equally opposed. They were opposed to the left, and they were very close and comfy with the right. Because the right, while it was out to destroy that democracy, the right was protecting the interests of property and the existing class structure. And that's the difference between the left and the right, and that's why a capitalist state tends to treat the right so much more leniently and the left so much more harshly. Let's look at what happened by the police and the courts under the Weimar Republic. These are the figures. Left-wing groups were charged with 22 murders. 38 people on the left were found guilty for those 28 murders. They averaged 15 years in prison. 10 of those 38 were executed. Among right-wing groups, 354 murders. What is that? That's about 60 times more the number of murders. Of these 354 murders, 326 were not even prosecuted. 23 were discharged. 23 people of the right-wing groups were discharged despite entering guilty pleas. They pleaded guilty to the murder and they were discharged. 24 were found guilty in part. Their average term in prison, 4 months. The number of them executed for the murders? None. So that's the way a state operated. Almost all the literature on fascism and Nazism concentrates on who supported Hitler, who supported Mussolini, who was behind him. Was it this group or that group and such? Oh, there was a couple of millionaires who didn't like them. Oh, there were some workers who did vote for them. So you can't really say it's one class or another. Well, I think you could pretty well say which class gave them the money, that gave them the visibility, the organization, and the numbers to some degree. But there's something else. Besides talking about who supported fascism, one thing these historians and political scientists never talk about is who did fascism support when fascism came into power? Who did the fascists support? Well, in Italy and Germany, when they came into power, they began implementing the stern measures that were needed to rescue the capitalist economy. Labor unions were dissolved. Strikes were outlawed. Union contracts were nullified. Prominent union leaders and other labor activists were imprisoned or murdered. Union property was confiscated. Worker publications were banned. Opposition political parties were outlawed. Their leaders jailed. Civil liberties were suspended. Fascist-sponsored unions, quote, unions, were set up, and their function was to speed up production, prevent wildcat strikes, and apply punitive regulations, including fines, dismissals, and imprisonments against workers who agitated or complained of shop conditions. I mean, even a Nazi labor front newspaper had to admit, quote, some shop regulations are reminiscent of penal codes. Workers no longer had the right to change jobs, They could be shifted from one employment to another regardless of their wishes. They could be conscripted for any work assumed useful to the nation's economy without guarantee of wages equal to previous earnings. In both Italy and Germany, the government exercised compulsory arbitration and regulation of work and wages. By the way, any worker who contested that would be contesting the laws of the state and therefore would be declared an enemy of the state, not just in conflict with management, but an enemy of the state. And so, in effect, what you got was a perfect wedding of the interests of the state and the interests of the capitalist class in this particular capitalist state. And by the way, these measures had their effect. According to figures supplied by the Italian press itself, the already meager wages, you know, the wages weren't all that good to begin with, for Italian workers in 1927 were cut in half by 1932. By 1939, the cost of living had risen 30%, and this constituted an additional increase in a decrease in real wages. Taxes on wages were introduced. Regulations were instated against minimum wages. The minimum wage law was abolished, in other words. There was no more increased pay for overtime. In some regions, sanitary and safety regulations were dropped. Occupational safety regulations were eliminated in factories. In many areas, child labor was reintroduced. In other words, all the old abuses and old evils that the Italians thought were dead, that were belonged to a generation ago, had returned under fascism. In Germany, the same story. Between 1933 and 1935, wages were lowered anywhere from 25 to 40%. That's a tremendous cut if you're an ordinary worker just trying to make ends meet. Wage taxes were instituted. Municipal poll taxes were doubled. Payroll deductions helped finance the Nazi-controlled labor front. And the Nazi labor front controlled the party organizations and the health and unemployment insurances, all of which, by the way, lowered wages another 20 and 30%. That is, the things that were taken out of your pay for that. And the non-profit mutual assistance and insurance associations that had existed before the Nazis came to power and the free labor unions were abolished. Their funds were taken over by private insurance companies that charged more while paying out smaller benefits. So, and in Italy, in Germany, just like in Italy, inflation substantially added to the German workers' hardship. There's something else both of these fascist leaders did. In both Italy and Germany, the process of privatization. Does that sound familiar? Ronald Reagan's dream. State-owned enterprises such as power plants, steel mills, banks, railways, insurance firms, steamship companies, and shipyards were handed over to private ownership. For a song, like gifts. Corporate taxes were reduced by half in both Italy and Germany. Does that sound familiar? Another Reagan achievement. Taxes on luxury items for the rich were cut. And inheritance taxes were either drastically lowered or abolished, just as they've been the last 10 years in America. In Germany, between 1934 and 1940, the average net income of corporate businessmen rose by 46%. Enterprises that were floundering were refloated with state bonds. They were recapitalized out of the state treasury, and they were returned to private control when solvent. So you see, these are people who say socialism doesn't work, but when capitalist businesses start to fail, they go socialist. They take the money out of the public treasure and refloat these businesses. Does that sound familiar to you people who are worrying about the S&L bailout? With numerous enterprises, the state guaranteed a return on the capital invested. They guaranteed a return and assumed all the risk of investment losses. So the investor, the rich investor, didn't have to worry about any losses, and if his business didn't do well, he'd get the money from the state treasury in any way. This is why the capitalists did like fascism. This, however, did not really bring a final solution. What the fascist state is, it attempts a final solution to the problem of class conflict. It obliterates the demands of the working class and the democratic forms that allow workers some room for an organized defense of their interests. But this final solution proves very far from final. In fascist Italy and Germany, industrial sabotage and sporadic wildcat strikes continued, inflation increased, whole sectors of the economy remained stagnant, there was widespread corruption, mismanagement, underemployment, vital social services deteriorated, but profits climbed. The profits went up, yes sir. The gestures made on behalf of the needy were pitiful. What the Nazis used to do is go around in the working class areas and collect alms. So they taxed the poor to give money to the still poorer, as Franz Schumann once said. The Italian economy remained in a troubled, stagnant condition right up to the Second World War. In Germany, thanks to the booming armaments industry, the standard of living improved a little bit, but it never even reached, by the way, it never even reached what it was in 1933 under the Weimar Republic. I mean, it never reached 1928 levels. So even under the Weimar Republic, for all its troubles, the levels of food, textile, and other areas of consumption and production were much better than ever achieved under Nazi Germany. Anyone interested in reading more about fascism, I would direct you to a very fine book by Daniel Guérin, G-U-E-R-I-N, called Fascism and Big Business. The writings of Franz Neumann are also worth looking at. Now, my references, on a couple of occasions here, I've made references to Reagan and Reaganism. I didn't mean to imply that Reagan was a fascist. In fact, quite the opposite. I meant to point out that in the American context, Reaganism met the same crisis that was going on, a similar crisis, it wasn't quite the same, but accomplished the same things within the existing framework, the political framework of the existing political system. He broke unions, but he didn't use death squads and terror squads. He broke them using consultation corporations, advisory corporations, spending hundreds of millions of dollars showing companies how to break unions. They broke unions by instituting one of the most restrictive and prohibitive and difficult laws, the Taft-Hartley Law, that goes back to 1940s, which make union organizing in America so very difficult. They've tried a number of times to limit our constitutional rights, the rights of free speech, the right of government accountability. They've cut inheritance taxes. They've cut the capital gains taxes. They've cut corporate taxes. They've abolished the progressive income tax. These are the accomplishments of the Ronald Reagan administration. While everyone talked about what a nitwit and a dingbat and a fool he was, Ronald Reagan did some very successful and brilliant things for his class. He rolled back the social democracy that had been developing in the late 60s and through the 70s. He cut back undermined human services. He staffed agencies and courts with people in government who do not believe in government and do not even carry out the programs that Congress voted in. So within the American context, he's done quite a few things short of what Hitler and Mussolini did as a final solution. And today I would also point out that in capitalist democracies in Western Europe and in the United States, the security forces have that same double standard that we discovered in Italy and in the Weimar Republic in Germany. Namely, they look the other way toward violence from the right, or seem to do very little, or seem seldom able to capture the perpetrators, unless the perpetrators are so crazy as to attack and kill police themselves. Then they go after them. But on the left, there's a constant surveillance, harassment, and in fact, sometimes outright murder. One can think of the systematic murder of the Black Panther Party, something like 30 of them killed in coordinated police attacks in cities throughout America. Or one can think of what's going on in West Germany, Italy, Belgium, Portugal today, where people on the left are being thrown in jail for astronomical sentences, while terrorists on the right seem to get by and get away with murder. Well, this is what we have to look at, and we have to understand that fascism is not just another ism out there. It's not just an aberration. It has a very rational side to it. It's a rational, functional form, and it can take diluted forms, and its propensities, its proclivities can exist even in the democratic state. That is, within that state, those police powers and those state powers can manifest some of the very same symptoms and all the worst attributes that you might find in a Nazi Germany or fascist Italy. Don't take my word for it. Just ask the CIA.
That was Michael Parenti's lecture, The Functions of Fascism, recorded November 30th, 1990, as part of the Real History series. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Polina Vasiliev, and myself, Thomas O'Rourke. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Thomas O'Rourke. Thanks for listening.